A Traverse City bookstore feels downright icky about selling copies of Harper Lee's much-anticipated ghost set of Watchmen. I don't think icky is too strong of a word. The management of Brilliant Books in Traverse is offering apologies and refunds, according to its website. Quote, "It is disappointing and frankly shameful to see our noble industry parade and celebrate this as Harper Lee's new novel. This is pure exploitation of both literary fans and a beloved American classic, which we hope has not been irrevocably tainted. We therefore encourage you to view Ghost Set a Watchman with intellectual curiosity and careful consideration. A rough beginning for a classic, but only that." Brilliant Books in Traverse City on its website. Its current state here on WKAR. Welcome back. I'm Mark Bayshore. Lansing voters narrowed the field of 2016 city council candidates in yesterday's primary election. In the capital city's third ward, voters chose challenger Adam Hussein and incumbent A'Lynn Bowles to square off in November. In yesterday's at-large runoff, voters chose our next two guests to be among the four on the ballot in November. Emily Devendorf is the former executive director of Equality Michigan, a statewide organization that advocates for the state's LGBT citizens. Welcome back, Emily.
Thank you.
And congratulations.
Thanks.
Patricia Spitzley is a Lansing-based official with the Racer Trust, which works to redevelop properties owned by General Motors before its 2009 bankruptcy. And Patricia's on the line from Traverse City today here. Welcome, Patricia.
Thank you. Good morning.
One hurdle down, one to go for both of you here. And I want to make clear, current state will invite both of the other at-large candidates, Carol Wood and Harold Lehman Jr., to join us before the general election to discuss the issues. Let me ask both of you to first to briefly explain why you chose to run. Patricia Spitzley, what about you?
Well, I've been looking at running for Lansing City Council for a while. I mean, I feel that public service is one of the highest things that you can do for your community. I've been on the Parks Board, and I am also on the Airport Board right now. And so, when an opportunity came and there was an open seat, I felt like this was the right time to run.
Emily Devendorf, what about you?
Yes, I also have a career in public service. I've been doing political work, public policy, and been working in civil rights. And I haven't had as much of a chance as I would have liked to focus on the local issues. I've been working statewide. I've been working on HIV advocacy, LGBT advocacy, statewide foreclosure reform at one time. So this was a great opportunity to buckle down and really have a direct impact on my community, on my neighborhoods.
And I'm led to believe that Mayor Bernero reached out to both of you about this. Patricia Spitzley, is that correct?
Well, a number of people have been talking to me about running. Again, you know, I've been on the Parks Board and I'm on the Airport Board. So again, when the open seat came, it was a good time to run. The mayor also reached out to me, but a number of other people have also reached out to me and asked me to run.
Would you have run if the mayor had not reached out to you?
I would not have run if there wasn't an open seat.
But did the mayor's conversation with you really make the difference?
The mayor did speak to me, but I spoke with my family and my children, and I also spoke to a number of people in the community that I trust before I made the decision. So it was a combination of all of those discussions and the open seat.
Emily, what about you?
I had not considered running for city council or any elected position before Vince Delgado decided not to run again, and I, too, had a conversation with the mayor. However, when I was approached by it, both by the mayor and a number of other local community leaders, I had the opportunity to sit down and think about whether I was satisfied with how Lansing was running itself, how our leaders were working together. And at a certain point, I actually had a conversation with my mom and was explaining how the campaign would work. And she said, "Emily, it doesn't even sound like you like these people." And I said, "Well, I like a lot of them as human beings. I know them and like them as human beings. But you're right. The way they're working together is irresponsible." And that is what ended up making the final decision for me.
Well, I don't want to belabor this because, strictly speaking, the mayor's not breaking any formal rules that I'm aware of by doing this, but he did reach out to both of you. Would you have run if the mayor had not reached out to you?
At this point in my career, I probably would have been continuing to do more background work in social justice and public policy. I don't tend to be somebody who loves to be the person in the front, but I'll do what needs to be done for my community. So I absolutely would not have considered it, not knowing that Vince Delgado was not going to run again. But after having heard that and hearing that I would have the support of Lansing City leaders, I felt like this was perhaps what I need to do right now for myself and my community.
Well, there's no shortage of more substantive issues to address than this. Let's move on. Issues involving the Lansing Board of Water and Light are probably the most discussed city issues these days. Before I ask whether the city should sell the Lansing Board of Water and Light, Patricia Spitzley, just tell us whether it's okay to explore that idea. Is that acceptable? Is that a good idea?
Well, I think the first thing we all need to do is just pause and take a deep breath. It's been in the press a lot, and it's a very inflammatory and polarizing subject. I think that, you know, as we are looking at trying to address some legacy issues with pensions and retirement costs, and as we're looking at balancing our budget and making sure we put money in our rainy day fund, we need to look at all of our assets and, you know, do a very detailed, thoughtful study into the value of all of our assets, into the whether or not it's appropriate to, you know, sell City Hall, look at our parks, and the Lansing Board of Water and Light is an asset that we should look at. Having said that, it's also an asset that I think is a wonderful tool for economic development. So any discussion about the sale of the Lansing Board of Water and Light cannot be done lightly. It must, you know, the review must be done thoughtfully. I propose a review and an audit of the Lansing Board of Water and Light, including its worth, but also how it's run, so that, you know, we can get that information from this independent source, have all the information in front of us, and then have a discussion, but have a thoughtful discussion, not a discussion in the press.
Well, you're not already on the record as opposing a sale then?
I do oppose the sale at this point. I do.
But your mind could be changed if after a careful deliberation?
I think it would be irresponsible for me to say, no, I would never consider selling the Lansing Board of Water and Light. I also think it's irresponsible of me to say, you know, yes, I will sell without, you know, looking at everything and without having this detailed review of the board and having a detailed review of all of our city assets.
Emily Devendorf, where do you stand regarding a sale, and where do you stand regarding studying a sale?
Yes, because to me they're very much two different things, and the study for me would have to be not just of the value of the Board of Water and Light and an evaluation of how that functions for the city and how we benefit, but it should be an evaluation, an inventory of how we're functioning as a city, period, whether the way that we are operating is sustainable for the short and long term. So I do believe that selling the Board of Water and Light should be an absolute last resort. I think that we're really jumping into this by saying that we may have a bankruptcy, and I do think we should absolutely look into exactly what the size of that crisis may be. But to have our answer to that immediately be to go to one of our greatest assets, as Patricia said. We should not be going to one of our most delectable wells in order to try to solve our crisis first and foremost. We should not be paying for our past mistakes with one of our greatest assets.
My guests on Current State, Emily Devendorf and Patricia Spitzley, both will be at-large candidates for Lansing City Council here coming this November after their success in last night's primary election. What did you make of Patricia, what did you make of the poll recently indicating significant resistance to the idea? 85%, I believe it was Epic MRA, polled 85% resistance to the idea of selling the BWL. Did that surprise you? Did that not surprise you? What?
Well, it didn't really surprise me. You know, I think that people recognize that the Board of Water and Light is a local gem, and, you know, and that it should be something that we don't, you know, throw away without a thoughtful process. I was on the Citizens Review Team when we looked at the board after the ice storm, and we went through and did a thoughtful review and came up with a number of recommendations. And one of those recommendations was to, you know, look at the processes, you know, look at, have a detailed review, have a detailed audit of the board, and look at processes of what need, you know, what needed to be changed. And so I still think we need to do that. I still think that we need to look at all of our assets in the city, not just the Lansing Board of Water and Light. And so, you know, I understand that concern about just, you know, selling it without having this thoughtful review.
Very good. Let's move on here. Emily Devendorf, what do you make of the plans for a possible casino for downtown Lansing? How open to that are you? Do you support it? Do you oppose it?
I actually oppose a casino in downtown Lansing. I come from the perspective of casinos as being, yes, revenue creators, yes, job creators, but I don't think we should be going to those who are most needy in order to solve any of our economic struggles. And essentially, I think that when we put an institution of gambling in the middle of an urban center, then we are taxing the poor in order to fill some gaps and
how,
to create
how,
that
how
growth.
Are you taxing the poor? Are you saying the poor tend to patronize casinos?
Well, yes and no. People who are in desperate situations look for quick fixes out of necessity, out of feeling of needing to get by. Needing to get their food on the table. And okay, if Lansing wants to create growth, we should be creating jobs and really finding ways to better support our communities and create better stability rather than to hang something out there that is just a quick fix.
Briefly, Patricia Spitzley, what do you favor a casino for downtown Lansing?
You know, I'm open to looking at all economic development opportunities to come into the city. I will say this. You know, I've been to communities where there is a casino in their downtown. Cleveland is a great example, and they seem to have done a very good job of marrying that activity into their downtown so that, you know, it is a positive venture. So I would be open to looking at all economic development opportunities.
The city council recently voted unanimously to rescind NioWave's $500,000 tax break with the city because the company failed to completely finish a remodel of a building in the Walnut neighborhood. Was the council right, Emily Devendorf, was the council right to vote to take that back?
I think the council was right to vote to take that back. Of course, that vote doesn't actually accomplish the rescinding of that because by state law, there is no way that is spelled out to rescind that tax abatement.
Correct. But it was a statement of principle, it would appear. Did you agree with that statement of principle? Would you have voted to rescind?
I do. I do believe that I agree with that statement of principle. It was a clear advocating for the needs of the community, and it was a statement that the community and our input was not involved or considered enough in this company's decision to build itself, how to build itself, and frankly, it was a promise broken.
We've got 1 minute. Patricia, I want to turn to you. How should Lansing residents view NioWave after this pole barn chapter and all of the fallout here? Are they good corporate citizens, or does this tarnish their reputation?
Well, I think it's unfortunate that the agreements that were entered or the promises made were not kept. I would have also voted to rescind the tax breaks, even though it didn't have an effect, but it was a solidarity vote because I think when companies come in and they make certain representations to the communities, they should keep those. You know, as a council member, I think I would work with the council and the administration to make sure that whatever development agreements that are entered into have a mechanism by which we can go back to a company like NIAWAVE and say, you didn't fulfill these commitments, and therefore X, Y, and Z can happen. We may not be able to rescind the tax breaks, but I think with a development agreement, we would be able to have a tool available to us to go back to them and help them to fulfill their promises.
Very good. So much more to talk about, but we are out of time, I'm afraid. We want to thank Patricia Spitzley, a Lansing-based official with the Racer Trust. She'll be a candidate for Lansing City Council at large, along with Emily Devendorf, former Executive Director of Equality Michigan, and another at-large candidate for Lansing City Council come November. Thanks to both of you. Good luck.
Thank you.
Well, the Lansing Lugnuts are in the midst of a three-game homestand against the Wisconsin Timber Rattlers tomorrow afternoon before the teams meet for their final game. A special ceremony will take place honoring Michigan's finest ball players, coaches, and one legendary announcer. The Michigan Baseball Hall of Fame is preparing to induct its first 10 members. They are Jim Abbott, Bill Freehand, Charlie Gehringer, Herney Harwell, Al Kaline, Hal Newhouser, Pat O'Keefe, John Smoltz, Alan Trammell, and Larry Tuttle. Current State's Kevin Lavery went to Cooley Law School Stadium to talk with Lugnuts announcer Jesse Goldberg-Strassler. The sky was blue. The air was loud with the sound of the stadium's ongoing redevelopment.
The first step was figuring out how those Hall of Famers would be chosen. Then we developed a selection committee. And then we asked Michiganders. We asked baseball fans throughout the state, nominate who you think belongs. And we had nominations come flooding in. And in the end, 75 coaches, players, teams, contributors were put together on a ballot. And I don't mean to say that there were 75 nominations, because some of these folks were nominated many, many times over. And from this ballot, they were sent to the selection committee. And they went through three rounds of voting, paring those names down. And the top 10 vote getters, we got that majority of the vote from the committee, and really unanimous. These are our 10 Hall of Famers.
We're standing near the center of the railing, Jesse, in front of the plaque honoring Lansing hero, John Smoltz. I don't think there's anybody in Michigan who's never at least heard of John Smoltz. Tell me about his career.
Well, John Smoltz was born in Detroit, and then he attended high school right here in the Lansing area. First at Lansing Catholic Central, and then he transferred to Waverly. Tim Stout, he was a member of the selection committee and will be emceeing our Michigan Baseball Hall of Fame induction ceremony. He loves to tell the story of the 1985 Diamond Classic. Now we know Smoltz for his pitching, but then he starred as a hitter and he hit the walk-off home run, beating Lansing Sexton. Clyde Weir, another member of the selection committee, he was scouting Smoltz. The Detroit Tigers drafted him. I don't think Clyde was a scout for the Tigers at the time. Now he is. Smoltz drafted by the Detroit Tigers, told Michigan State in their full scholarship offer, thank you, but I'm going to try professional baseball. Then he was traded to the Atlanta Braves. Now, a National Baseball Hall of Fame career followed, over 200 wins, over 150 saves.
Popped him up! Renteria at short. History for John Smoltz in Atlanta, number 200 against the Mets.
But I think in Smoltz, I think in some of these other inductees, you see the breadth of what we're covering. Whether it's someone like Smoltz who grew up here in Lansing and then went elsewhere to achieve great baseball success, or whether it's someone like Ernie Harwell who grew up in Georgia and became the voice of baseball in Michigan. It spans that landscape, all those ways that Michiganders can be shown, hey, you can make a positive impact upon the game of baseball.
Show me somebody else here on this Walk of Fame who's a little less well-known, perhaps.
Well, let's walk along here to Coach Larry Tuttle. Oh, actually, I guess Larry Tuttle's over on the other side. So Larry Tuttle is the head coach of the Blissfield Royals. Started coaching at Blissfield in the 1960s. Was the very first head baseball coach in the state of Michigan to win over 1,000 games at the high school level. Won 7 state titles. 19 times he won the Lenawee County Conference title. This is someone who deserves to be honored. This is a hero. This is someone who built up not just a dynasty, but affected how many kids' lives as he went over the course of his coaching career decade after decade, and he is still going. And Blissfield High School baseball throughout the spring, and then coaching summer ball. Maybe you know the name Bill Freehand, the great catcher for the Tigers. Maybe you listen to Ernie Harwell for year after year after year. But Larry Tuttle's name deserves to be placed right alongside.
We're talking with Jesse Goldberg-Strassler, the radio announcer for the Lansing Lugnuts. Well, let's talk about Al Kaline.
Al Kaline's born in Baltimore. I don't know about you, but after high school for me, find a summer job, you head off to college. Al Kaline, the day after he graduated high school, was offered a contract by the Detroit Tigers. And at 18 years of age, he takes over in the Tigers' outfield. And what a right fielder. This is Mr. Tiger, 22 seasons in Detroit, over 3,000 hits. Noted for his bat, noted for his power, noted for his defense, and his throwing arm. I mean, my goodness, 10 gold gloves, 18 All-Star games. And after his playing career finished, then being the color commentator for the Tigers for 25 more seasons on the broadcasts. When you're talking about someone who meant a lot to Michigan and to Detroit Tiger baseball in specific, and all of those Michiganders who grew up loving their Tigers, that's Al Kaline.
The Michigan Baseball Hall of Fame probably doesn't have the same recognition as the National Baseball Hall of Fame in Cooperstown, but what does that really do for an inductee?
It localizes it. Cooperstown is considered a magical place, and if you've been there, you know it's tucked out of the way. You really have to go there. You've got a long drive. You got to go through the hills of New York. The Michigan Baseball Hall of Fame brings it back home. Charlie Gehringer is enshrined in Cooperstown, one of the great second basemen in the history of baseball. And he grew up in Fowlerville, went to Fowlerville High School. His family is still around the Michigan area, and he has a huge family. So some have gone elsewhere, but he's Michigan, and he starred for the Detroit Tigers. He was signed to a contract by Ty Cobb himself after a tryout. It brings it back home. It is one thing for everybody to appreciate you, but they're appreciating you way out there. Well, you want your family and friends to be able to say, this is where you're from. And where you're from loves you and wants to show how much that they admire what you did. You came from this area and you excelled. And so a kid growing up just down the street can say, well, here's where I am. I don't know any superstars personally yet, but that could be me. Because he grew up just like me. Charlie Gehringer grew up on a farm. And maybe someone else grew up on a suburb. John Smoltz, right down the street. Whatever that background is, and whatever it is that you aspire to, you can reach the very heights of it. That's the Michigan Baseball Hall of Fame. We're honoring the past. We're inspiring the future.
Jesse Goldberg-Strassler is the radio announcer, the voice of the Lansing Lugnuts. You mentioned Ty Cobb, the Georgia Peach. His fellow Georgian, Ernie Harwell, is a couple of plaques over, but Ty Cobb is not here.
Ty Cobb is not here. The first season of inductions. I would not be surprised if Ty Cobb is enshrined in the Michigan Baseball Hall of Fame before too long. He was the greatest Tiger, you could argue, ever. It'd be a fun argument. There were many who argued that Ty Cobb was the greatest baseball player ever. And the fact that now Babe Ruth is considered the greatest baseball player ever, this is more of a recent thing. It is not what you might assume, that ever since Babe Ruth started swatting more home runs than entire teams, that everyone said Babe is the superstar of the game, Babe is the best. No, Ty Cobb, for the best, I would say, the first half century of baseball, he was considered a force of nature. He was considered every single thing that you could aspire to be on the diamond. But don't peeve him. Don't get on his bad side, because whatever he could do, he would beat you. Whether it was on the bases, whether it was at home plate, he was the ultimate competitor, and he was the guy that put the Tigers on the map. He lifted the Tigers up to be one of the best teams in the American League and competing at the highest level. So no, Ty Cobb's plaque isn't here yet. That doesn't mean that it's not going to be here before too long.
So when the induction ceremony begins at 5:00 Thursday afternoon, I'm assuming that the barrage of sound that means progress will be silent for a while, and what will happen at that afternoon?
Well, yes, it's the same thing as when a baseball game starts, they stop chalking the foul lines. Those foul lines are ready. The infield is prepared. Home plate is looking great. And it's time to play ball. It'll be time for us to induct our inaugural class. Tim Stout will be our MC. 5 o'clock, we'll welcome everybody in. And then from 5:30 to 6:30, we'll honor our inaugural class of inductees. We have families who are here. We have inductees who are coming. John Smoltz, for example, is unable to attend, but John Smoltz Sr., his mother, his sister, they'll be here, and we'll honor that inaugural class. And then we'll step outside and we'll reveal the plaques for the very first time so that everybody can see what the Michigan Baseball Hall of Fame looks like. So you have an exclusive. You and I are two of the first people to ever see these plaques, and my first time looking at them was standing at your side.
Jesse Goldberg Strassler, the voice of the Lansing Lugnuts radio broadcaster. The Michigan Baseball Hall of Fame induction ceremony tomorrow afternoon, 5 o'clock here at Cooley Law School Stadium. What a great day for the event. Thanks, Jesse.
Kevin, thank you very much.
For Current State, I'm Kevin Lavery.
Now God has a new adventure for me, and I'm ready to move on. So I leave you with a deep sense of appreciation for your longtime loyalty and support. I thank you very much, and God bless all of you.
Coming up on Current State, a dispute between neighbors or a fight between high school students is pretty common, but sometimes those conflicts can land people in court or end with students expelled from school. For this week's Neighbors in Action segment, we talk to Resolution Services, a nonprofit that helps people resolve disputes. Plus, Civil War era cannons are returning to the state capitol grounds for the first time since World War II. We talked to the two state senators who worked across the aisle to raise the money to have them replaced. That and more after the break on Current State. Don't forget, Current State broadcasts live this Friday evening from East Lansing's Great Lakes Folk Festival, which runs this weekend. We'll be looking for you. We hope you're looking for us right across the street from Harper's and behind Beggar's Banquet there in the city parking lot. We'll have live music and interesting guests participating in the Folk Festival. Hope you can make it. Hope you can listen. Wednesday on Current State means it's time for Neighbors in Action, when we feature people and organizations working to make Greater Lansing a better place. Today we learn about the Resolution Services Center. The local nonprofit aims to help people resolve conflicts without having to involve courts or have students removed from school. To learn more about the center, I talked to Executive Director Greta Trice yesterday here in Studio S. We were also joined by Dolores Campbell and her son Zarin, who participated in the center's restorative justice program at a Lansing area high school. I started out by asking Greta what kinds of conflicts the organization typically deals with.
We deal with mediations in the court systems, in the neighborhood, and in the school systems. That's the work that we pride ourselves on. So we help people resolve conflicts in schools when it involves bullying or violence or disputes in the schools or sometimes behavior issues.
What kind of skills does a good mediator have?
Well, obviously good communication skills, non-judgmental. There's a training, a specific training for all our court mediations. It's a 48-hour for domestic and a 40-hour for general civil disputes. In the schools, they have to have at least what we call a restorative justice background training, which can be from 3 days somewhere, usually 2.5 to 3 days, just facilitative training process, and then much observation before they are put into the system.
Let's move now to the work that Resolution Services Center is doing inside of schools as well. You call these restorative justice programs. Mm-hmm. Can you give us a quick definition of what restorative justice means?
Well, it's a process. It's an age-old process of thinking about how to resolve conflict. It stems from Indigenous people in New Zealand and other Native American people and Native tribal communities that sought to resolve conflicts communally. We find out that the people that have issues are very well suited to understand what the nature of those issues are, what's their vested interest, why it came about. So it's a philosophy that I like to say, and a process that asks basically three fundamental questions. And those questions are, what happened? Who's been affected and how? And lastly, what must we do to fix it, resolve it?
Mm. Zarin, you went through the mediation with the Restorative Justice Program. Can you tell me a little bit about the situation that led you to the mediation?
Yes, well, a longtime friend and I, we went to the band room and we started to mess around. And next thing I knew, that I was getting expelled.
This was a male friend or a female friend?
Female.
So Dolores, Zarin was accused of inappropriately touching this girl, correct?
Yes.
Okay. When you first heard from the school about this situation, what was your reaction?
Well, I didn't hear exactly what happened. I just heard that he was being suspended and he was getting dropped off, and that's all I knew. And it took a minute for me to really find out what was going on.
And what kind of communication did you have with the school, the girl's parents, any communication with the police?
With the school, I had very little communication just because it was snow days as well as they didn't have school that day. So it was a little hard to talk to the school when it first happened. And the girl's parents, none at all. And with the police, still very little. So it was a little frustrating.
Greta, in a situation like this, when would resolution services step in?
In this particular situation, we were called as Zarin was about to be reentered into the learning environment. It depends on the nature of the situation and when we can get called in. Ideally, we're called in early, but if it's a very serious offense, the school by rights have to do some investigation to find out what's going on and if everybody's safe, and determine if what kinds of things have to happen.
Zarin, when you got the news that you were going to be kicked out of school, what was going through your mind?
A million things were going through my mind. How my parents would react, because I didn't know exactly how they were going to go about it. So my mind jumped to worst case scenarios, and I was just worried about a lot of things.
So, Dolores, how did you and Zarin finally connect with Resolution Services?
Student Services ended up calling me, and they said that they wanted to set up an appointment with Resolution Services so that Zarin would be able to get back in school. And I said, cool. And that's how we ended up connecting, and they were awesome.
Zarin, what was it like when you finally sat down with the girl who had accused you of touching her inappropriately? What was that conversation like?
The conversation with her was no anger towards either of us. I think the both of us just wanted it to be over with.
Dolores, what difference did it make to have Resolution Services involved in this?
Oh, my gosh. It was like a light at the end of the tunnel. I mean, it was just refreshing to finally have someone listen. So I was very thankful.
Greta, it seems like mediators are going to be dealing with some pretty sensitive situations, think sexual situations, assaults, bullying, fights. How do you train a mediator to help people come to an agreement in a situation that might be pretty emotional?
Well, the process that we use basically supports a conversation between the parties. So it is a very guided and facilitative process. By doing an intake first, you get a chance to hear from each person. They're not together when you do the intake. You get a chance to hear what the perspectives that they're coming to the table with. And you're being trained to listen. That's one of the key components. You're listening for what matters most to this person. Are they interested in getting the name cleared? Are they interested in having an apology? Are they interested in getting revenge? What do they want? What's important to them? Because a conflict is all about wants. So, you know, you don't have disagreements about something you're not really passionate about, usually. When I talked to Zarin and I talked to the other female student, I understood probably better, I think, than most people probably would have. Because I'm not looking for evidence. I'm not looking to see who's right, who's wrong, per se. I'm looking to see what's happened.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not here to do an investigation. I don't have the authority to let you in or keep you out. We're neutral. We're just interested in helping them get through the situation to a resolution.
To what extent are the parents typically involved in these situations?
Ideally, in a situation like this, they are actively involved, and we have many sessions where both parents are at the table. I've even had clergy, I've had grandparents come. So it's a community concept that everybody has a vested interest in this. He understood that his mom was affected by this. Zarin understood that his teachers and his other classmates were affected by this. And so the people that have the direct impact of the conflict should be at the table.
Greta Trice is the executive director of the Resolution Services Center in Lansing. We're talking about the organization's restorative justice program in Lansing Public Schools. We're also joined today by Dolores Campbell and her son, Zarin, who used Resolution Services after Zarin was suspended from a Lansing area high school. Dolores, what were you most worried about when this situation erupted here? I mean, we hear a lot about the challenges kids face when they're suspended or expelled from school. What were you most worried about that might come of this situation?
I didn't know. I think that was the biggest thing. I didn't know what was going to happen. I wasn't communicated to the way I should have been, and I just didn't know. So everything was left up in the air until the very end.
Were you concerned for Zarin's education in this?
I was concerned for his education, his livelihood, everything. Mm.
Zarin, do you feel that after Resolution Services Center got involved, do you feel like the whole process became more manageable? Did you feel more confident that you'd be able to resolve this situation?
Yes, I felt loads more confident that the Resolution people would help because they actually listened to what we had to say.
Okay. Greta, why do you think it's important for schools to have restorative justice programs as an alternative to suspensions and expulsions?
Because there are so many reasons to keep kids in school. Suspensions do not work. They punish, and they are necessary at times.
Suspensions don't work, ever?
What do we suspend people for, right? If it's punishment. I don't believe, and restorative practices doesn't believe, that punishment teaches. It's the process that when we punish our kids, we may have spanked them, put them in time out. It's that conversation afterwards that the learning takes place.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't that, you know, well, they got in trouble. That's not the teaching tool. The teaching tool was, you're in trouble because I want to keep you safe. I want you to be obedient. I want you to learn. And it's those moments of intimacy that we have with our kids. And that's what restorative justice does. It provides moments of intimacy between people.
Are there volunteer opportunities for people to get involved with the Resolution Services Center, either in schools or in your work in the court
Most
system?
Most definitely.
There are.
Just contact our agency. We need facilitators that can go in and help to be trained. We need community representatives that serve sometimes in as a role of what students' behavior has on the community as a whole. The restorative model is to help people see that they're not an island unto themselves, that we are in connectionships with each other, force or choice.
We've been talking about the Resolution Services Center, a Lansing nonprofit that helps resolve conflicts outside of court and also runs a restorative justice program in the Lansing Public Schools. Our guests today have been Executive Director Greta Trice and Dolores Campbell and her son Zarin, who participated in a Resolution Services mediation at an area school. Thanks to all of you for joining us. And Current State is looking for more nominations for our Neighbors in Action feature. Please help us out. Email us your suggestions to currentstate@wkar.org. Please put Neighbors in Action in the subject line or tweet us at KAR Current State and tell us a little bit about why you think they should be featured for the great work they do. Here's a bit of history for you involving our state capitol building. Two Civil War era cannons were removed from the state capitol grounds back in 1946, possibly for a World War II scrap metal drive. They'd been there since 1879. They'd been known as Loomis guns in honor of Captain Cyrus O. Loomis, who ran a Civil War battery out of Coldwater, Michigan. On Saturday, cannons will return to flank the steps of the Capitol, culminating a 2-year bipartisan effort to raise private funds for the project. Two state senators reached across the aisle to bring the Loomis gun replicas back to Lansing. Last week, we talked with White Lake Republican Mike Kowal and Warren Democrat Steve Beda about their project. Kowal explained that he and Beda are both history buffs.
We had the fortune of sitting next to one another in the last 4 years, and when you sit next to somebody for long periods of time, especially in those sessions that run late, you end up finding more and more about each other.
Uh-huh.
And we both have an interest in the canon, and we decided to embark on a bipartisan fundraising venture. Of course, we raised all private funds to achieve this goal, but we did it together, and it's partially a passion that we both have. We want to leave a lasting mark in the Capitol, not just legislation that's going to go into a dusty history book someplace, but something that's right out on the front lawn that our grandchildren and great-grandchildren and everybody else's kids can see as well.
These are called Loomis guns, I'm told,
yeah,
after Cyrus Loomis of Michigan.
That's correct. It was a battery, also called the Coldwater Battery, and they fought in a number of major campaigns in the Civil War and actually have a really illustrious history there. So that's why those cannon were chosen to originally be placed in a place of honor in front of the state capitol. Interestingly enough, back then, they were kind of aiming out. Now they aim, one will be aimed at the governor's office, and the other will be aimed at the mayor of Lansing's office.
In true bipartisan fashion.
In true bipartisan fashion, and that actually helped us raise funds for these cannon too, by the way, but we had some safety concerns that were brought up from some people that were not so much fun, and so they're not going to be firing at all.
Yeah, but state police didn't have a sense of humor at all when I wanted them to shoot.
Yeah. We're talking with State Senators Steve Beda and Mike Kowal about their joint effort to get replica Civil War-era cannons returned to the state capitol grounds. There will be a ceremony at the Capitol Saturday at 12 o'clock noon. Was the sesquicentennial of the Civil War a reason for the timing of this?
Yes, that was part of the timing. The other part was the restoration work that's currently going on in the Capitol building on the dome right now.
Right.
We wanted to make sure that the grounds were also being brought up to date and being put back in the original fashion of which they were built.
Describe the cannons for us, Steve.
Well, they're maybe bronze. They're I'm told they're 10 pounds, but I think that's the amount of shot that they shoot out on it. And they're historically accurate replicas. They're being cast by a company in Tennessee that actually does a lot of work for the National Park Service in replica cannon of this fashion.
Okay, I'm led to
believe. So they're going to be historically accurate cannon. There's going to be a little insignia on each one of them in honor of the sesquicentennial of the American Civil War, which we're in the last year of marking the sesquicentennial. 150th anniversary, for those who don't recognize that word, because we don't usually use that in everyday language.
Right.
That emblem will be on each cannon as a commemoration of the end of the Civil War.
Your staffs are making much of this effort being bipartisan here. Describe your personal and professional relationship here. You've obviously, proximity played a role in this.
Well, proximity was what got it started.
Yeah, we
sat next to each other for 4 years and found out we had a lot in common, and history being one of them. And we've actually worked on a couple other collaborative efforts together. The Automobile Caucus, which we both jointly founded. Strange enough, Michigan's an auto state, but we never had an auto caucus in the legislature. So it's another project that we worked together on. But proximity and both also common interest on the state's history and in federal history. And I would say a very deep and abiding respect and admiration for veterans. And we're designating even those as for the sesquicentennial of the Civil War, and it's an honor of those veterans. It's really an honor of all the veterans from all the wars that fought. And that's why our invitations have gone out, not only to historical societies, but to all the veterans groups in this country, because it is really important that we recognize the sacrifice that the veterans and their families had.
Do your colleagues appreciate the bipartisan nature of this effort?
Our colleagues are, they're very supportive of what we're doing. They know Steve and I are friends. We've developed a relationship both in the Capitol building, a respect for each other. It's interesting, if we're voting on issues we don't agree on, we would kind of turn our back to each other, hit the button, let it get over for a couple of minutes, and go back to talking about other things.
Civil War.
Oh, it's kind of
Civil
awkward. War. Kind of awkward when you're voting no on the other one's bill, but that's another story.
That's another story entirely, so we just put that aside and just keep going.
Taking any grief for working with each other across the aisle like this?
No, I think people do appreciate it, and I think a lot of people think that we're Republicans and Democrats are always at everybody's throats, and it's not really like that. And that's a good thing, because to get together, to accomplish something, you have to work across party lines. And I think that's a real important thing, not only in this, and it's kind of ironic that you would have something that's commemorating maybe the most bloody war amongst ourselves that becomes a bipartisan endeavor to commemorate the 150th anniversary of the end of that discord. So, but it is important, and I think not just for this, but for everything else we do in the state, that we try to find those places where we work together. And there's going to be places that the line's going to be in the sand, but there's definitely a lot of places that we do work together.
Steve and I have worked together a lot on a lot of the animal rights issues, because those are important to both of us as well. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the legislature having the complexion that it has right now, there's only 11 of them. So, I mean, how much damage can they do?
It's true.
State Senators Mike Kowal and Steve Beda are my guests. They're from different parties, but they've worked together to raise the money for replacing two Civil War-era cannons to the state Capitol grounds, and those will be returned on Saturday. Talk to us about Saturday's ceremony.
That's
here.
Saturday, August 8th. And it's the ceremony is going to begin at noon. Recommend maybe people get there a little earlier. We're going to have some Civil War reenactors, soldiers, a Civil War era band.
Correct.
And also we have a Civil War era, actually an Abraham Lincoln reenactor.
Okay.
That's going to be speaking to the crowd, and his real name is Ron Carly out of Livonia, and does a marvelous job. We may actually have a Grant impersonator as well. And I suppose if I mention this on air, we'll probably get 20 Grant impersonators out there, but the more the merrier. But it's going to be a really good ceremony. We'll have the formal dedication of the cannon.
Will you fire the cannons?
Well, we're hoping that we have a real Loomis gun show up. We're told by the Capitol Services that they were working on that. And in memory of the guns, and to dedicate them, they plan on firing the Loomis cannon when it's there. So we're getting clearance from state police and all the other entities that are involved. So it's exciting. It'll be something to bring your kids to, so they can remember that as they get older.
You spearheaded a private fundraising effort to get these cannons. No tax dollars have been spent. How much money are we talking about here?
Well, we raised almost
about $80,000 right now.
Yeah, in that neighborhood.
With the recent controversy over the Confederate flag, including the removal of the stars and bars from the state capitol in South Carolina, are you expecting anything controversial like that? Anybody to show up with the stars and
know,
bars?
You know, we were a Union state, and we've sent our troops in fighting on behalf of the Union, and you know, kind of to put it delicately, we won. And it was a good thing that we won, and it was a good thing that
it's interesting how many kind of enthusiasts there are of the Confederate flag out there, no matter where you are.
No matter where you are, you're apt
to run into somebody who likes it.
I saw one going down M-59, the back of a pickup truck the other day, along with an American flag. And I think it's more of a statement saying "Don't tell me what to do," than making a statement about slavery.
And there is there's different interpretations of it, and it's used in different contexts. And you know, I think part of the official ceremony, just as it was when the Capitol was dedicated to the soldiers of the Union, it is a Union commemoration, and that's what those cannons were. Symbolic of. But going back to one other thing, part of the ceremony we just found in the last couple of days, we're going to have a special display of the history of the Loomis Battery that will also be inside the Capitol that visitors can see as well. And the Capitol building will be open on Saturday, and it's typically not. So it'll be someplace there'll be restrooms and stuff like that, but also there'll be a special display in the cannon and some of the memorabilia related to that. And I think if you're interested in history, or if you're in Lansing, or if you're traveling through, it's going to be a worthwhile stop, I think. It'll be a great photo exhibit. You could do a selfie with Abraham Lincoln if you want.
And you can come in and see all the battle flags that are on display permanently in the dome of the Capitol. Those are replicas of some of the original flags that were actually taken in the battle in the Civil War.
Michigan Senators Steve Beda and Mike Kowal led the fundraising effort to bring replica Civil War cannons back to the state capitol grounds in Lansing. There will be a ceremony at the Capitol at noon on Saturday. Senator Kowal, Senator Beda, thank you.
Thank you very much.
And that's our show for today. Tomorrow on Current State, a new City of Lansing program is creating automatic savings accounts for children enrolling in kindergarten in Lansing Public Schools. We talked to Amber Paxton of the city's Office of Financial Empowerment and San Francisco City Treasurer Jose Cisneros, who started a similar program in the city. Plus, Kosacek's department store has been dressing men in high-end apparel for 150 years. Current State's Kevin Lavery pays a visit to the fourth-generation family business to learn the secret behind their longevity. That and more tomorrow on Current State. Don't forget, we're at the Great Lakes Folk Festival live Friday evening at 6. Join us. The executive producer of Current State is Peter Worf. April Van Buren directed our show today. Thanks also to Melissa Benmark, Scott Pohl, Kevin Lavery, and Drew Hill. Don't forget, subscribe to our podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts. On social media, we're at KAR Current State on Twitter. On Facebook, Current State from WKAR. Glad you could join us. See you Thursday. It's Current State from WKAR.